As New Letters on the Air tries to find a way past the COVID budget cuts, we begin our classic series. Today, you will hear excerpts from five shows submitted to the Association for Women in Communications to compete for their National Clarion Award, which we won in 2013 for Best Radio Interview Program. Stay with us for insight into crafting fiction, poetry, and a poetic musical drama as we hear from Jamaica Kincaid, Luis Alberto Urrea, Jim Shepherd, Alex George, and mother-daughter poets Gloria Vando and Annika Paris in the special Clarion collection of New Letters on the Air, a production of UMKC's New Letters magazine. I'm Angela Elam. Every writer, at one point or other, is encouraged to write what you know. But I've observed that many write what they want to figure out in life, and family often offers inspiration, even in absence. Jamaica Kincaid was born Elaine Potter Richardson, an illegitimate child on the island of Antigua who never really knew her father. She left as a teenager to become an au pair in the States and ended up writing for The New Yorker. Now the author of over a dozen books, Kincaid was a 2012 Hall Center for the Humanities lecturer at the University of Kansas, where we discussed her work, including her novel Mr. Potter, loosely based on her unknown father, and what the writing process does for her.
I've never found my own work interesting once I'm finished writing it.
Once you've gotten it out there, you might be done with it, maybe.
Yes. I've come to say it's not about my own ambition to be a writer in the world. It's about my ambition to write. And I never think anyone will read it. But when I'm writing it, there are so many times when the sheer joy of doing it, where I figure out how a sentence works and I got the weight of the words right and the feeling right and all these things that are not necessarily agreeable with each other, but I've got them in the right balance. Ordinarily, to convey a feeling or to say what you want to say is one thing, and the words are another, and they can be in conflict, or not just in conflict, they might not want to cooperate and be at their best at the same time, which is why you often have crappy writing. because a bad piece of writing will say one thing, but a good piece of writing, the two things come together, what you want to say and then the right words to say it. And when that happens, it's just, at least I find when I believe I'm doing it, to be the most wonderful feeling in the entire world.
One of the things that you're really known for is your lyrical language. And I've noticed how you use kind of circular movement in your language to not only create a rhythm, but to create an atmosphere almost. And I thought one passage that particularly points this out is the very beginning of the book, Mr. Potter. It's actually the introduction.
Yes,
in a way.
And I believe the first paragraph is almost one sentence long, or so it comes close, but here it goes. And that day the sun was in its usual place, up above and in the middle of the sky, and it shone in its usual way, so harshly bright, making even the shadows pale, making even the shadows seek shelter. That day the sun was in its usual place, up above and in the middle of the sky, but Mr. Potter did not note this, so accustomed was he to this, the sun in its usual place, up above and in the middle of the sky. If the sun had not been in its usual place, that would have made a great big change in Mr. Potter's day. It would have meant rain, however briefly such a thing, rain, might fall, but it would have changed Mr. Potter's day. So used was he to the sun in its usual place, way up above and in the middle of the sky. Mr. Potter breathed in his normal way. His heart was beating in its normal way, up and down, underneath the covering of his black skin, up and down underneath his white knitted cotton vest, next to his very black skin, up and down underneath his plain woven white cotton shirt that was on top of the knitted cotton vest which lay next to his skin. So his heart breathed in its normal way, and he put on his trousers, and in the pocket of his trousers he placed a white handkerchief, and all this was as normal as the way his heart beat. All this He's putting on his clothes in just that way, as normal as the way his heart beat, the heart beating normally, and the clothes reassuring to Mr. Potter and to things beyond Mr. Potter, things that did not know they needed such reassurance.
Jamaica Kincaid, reading from her novel, Mr. Potter. In 2013, her next novel, See Now Then, was released. This is New Letters on the Air. Like Jamaica Kincaid, Luis Alberto Urrea was also inspired by family history, in particular the mystical lore surrounding the Saint of Cabora. This author of fiction, memoir, poetry, and even graphic novels talks about why he wrote about her in his novels The Hummingbird's Daughter and its sequel, Queen of America.
My family on the Mexican side has always been a little odd and a little mystical.
Sort of like your book.
Well, yeah, it ties in pretty straight to, I think, the Saint of Cabora story. The whole family has these vibes. You know, one of the duties I've had as a writer is to complete this Teresita saga, and I've done 26 years on it.
What was the very beginning of The Hummingbird's Daughter? Can you even remember?
Yes.
Was it a poem? Was it a story?
It wasn't any writing at all. It was being a child in Tijuana listening to crazy aunts tell these stories. And there were many stories about many things, and all of them outrageous and impossible and often designed to terrorize us as kids because our aunts found that really amusing. And among these myths and legends were these stories about our fabled Yaqui aunt. You have a Yaqui Indian aunt, you know. You'd say, really? Yes. And she can fly, you know. We'd say, she can fly? Yes. And she could raise the dead, you know. And you go through your boyhood hearing these tales, and at first you believe them, and then you disbelieve them, and then you think, well, it's just folklore. And after I graduated from college, I went to work at a community college as a bilingual TA in a Chicano studies program, and the professor I was working for said, you are related to the saint, aren't you? And I said, what saint? And he said, the Saint of Cabora.
How did he know that?
She's quite famous. I didn't know she was famous. I thought she was a family secret. And he brought out North from Mexico by Carrie McWilliams, which has a chapter about her. And I almost fell over. I could not believe that a textbook had a chapter about this woman. It was one of those moments where the paradigm shifts. You know, all of a sudden, what you think is possibly fake family legend slams you in the face as reality with footnotes. And I thought, this is not possible. I Xeroxed the essay from the book and I showed it to the family. I was suddenly the expert. I have some research about Teresita. So that moment in 1978 is where it really began, when I realized that she was real. And as soon as that happened, then these weird, what I call medicine paths began to open up. Medicine people and shaman types and curanderas and curanderos would keep appearing. And it was as though as soon as I understood that she was real and who she was, from wherever in the cosmos she resides now, she seemed to have responded. That's what the medicine people said. She sent the forces galloping toward me. Whether that's true or not, it's a very interesting way to approach research. So this book had this really interesting other thing going on of oral history or participation by actual direct blood descendants, Teresita's children, in effect, telling stories to us, which was really interesting. But then, you know, you start feeling a bit of dread. You're writing a book about someone's mom or grandma or great-grandma. That's a little intimidating. But I just had to swallow that pill and just forge ahead, you know. And everybody understood, I think, that this was my dream of the story. And I thought it was too great a story and she was too great a character to just disappear. And I really wanted to give a gift to my family, all the generations after her. It was about bringing this story to life and knowing that I had composed my version of a symphony. That's what I wanted. I wanted to take this story from this small point and take it to this unbelievable crescendo and then bring it back down to this small point, which is how her life played out.
Sometimes these stories are gifts. Yeah. I mean, this story was presented to you, yeah, and you honored it by doing the telling of it.
I think so. I mean, when I teach workshops, I try to point out to people that we don't believe it's a world full of miracle because we're busy watching American Idol and we're worried about the credit ratings dropping and we're worried about the housing bubble and I have to get to work and we're worried about all this stuff. And the fact is the world sends us wonderful things all day long. So I always tell students now that every day of your life is your birthday. You forget because you have worries and heartbreaks and problems, but every day is your birthday. Even the worst day of your life, you're going to receive these little presents, but you're not going to see them unless you learn to pay attention.
The wisdom of Luis Alberto Urrea, author of the novel Queen of America. While he finds gifts, Jim Shepherd actively searches for his topics. This fiction writer takes on tragedy by blending satire with real-world angst. I spoke with him at the Kansas City Public Library on February 27, 2012, while he was the Cockafair Chair Writer-in-Residence at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. The subject of his sixth novel, Project X, couldn't have been more relevant. This is going to start on such a serious note, but we had the school shooting this morning in Ohio. And I couldn't help but think of your book, Project X,
right,
which involves a school shooting. Actually, why don't you talk a little bit about Project X?
Project X began where so many of my projects begin, in a kind of fit of impotent rage, because I was, on the one hand, unable to complete the project I had been working on and thought, maybe you should try and do something that you can do. And that was channel an enraged adolescent, because I was an enraged adolescent, essentially, and I went to an incredibly awful school. And I had also been very upset with the media's handling of the Columbine shootings, especially the notion that all of this had to do with, you know, too much Marilyn Manson or too much whatever. And in some ways, stripping them of the sort of spectacular dysfunction and misery that had produced the shootings in the first place. And I also had remembered very viscerally a discussion that I'd had in ninth grade with a boy who had come in at the lunch table and had said that he was tired of being bullied by one of the football players and that he was going to bring in his dad's hunting rifle and kill the football player. And he wanted to know what we thought of that idea. And the good news was there was about 8 people around the table and the vote was 8-0 that he shouldn't do it. But the bad news was the argument that seemed to clinch it for him was, we said, look, it's a hunting rifle. You're going to kill like one guy, and then they're going to wrestle you to the ground and beat you to death. You know, is that worth it? And he was like, yeah, that's a good point. And if he had said, as the Columbine boys had said, no, I actually have an automatic weapon, and I'm going to be able to hold people off for quite a while, you know, we would have had many fewer arguments. So that aspect of adolescent fantasy fulfillment that the power of an automatic weapon confers on you, I thought, had been neglected in the story as well. That ability to sort of say, all of you are in my thrall for the immediate future, I thought was not a small part of what drew those two boys to what they had done. And I thought that that was also part of the discussion that had gone away. So I began the novel, but really what I was doing was channeling how absolutely miserable almost everybody in my school had been almost the whole time. And I was drawn to how much comedy there is in it, even as these kids are suffering. But as my loved ones will tell you, I find a lot of comedy in human suffering.
Well, I was going to have you read a little bit of Project X.
But there's so much bad language in it. Is that,
I know,
seem wise?
I know. But there is a little short piece in...
she goes, I did find one phrase...
There's a short piece in your collection of short stories. You think that's bad. There's the beginning of one of the stories that I think captures the mood of a lot of your characters, your young characters, and it's the very beginning of Boys Town.
Mm-hmm.
It's very short.
Oh, so you're going to make me stop right before the swear word, aren't you?
Yes,
that's
I am.
Very nice. But a lot of my narrators both have this real desire to communicate, and they have this despairing sense that they're not going to be understood anyway. And so that duality is very interesting to me. That sort of, I really want to talk about this, but what are the chances you're going to be able to understand what I'm saying anyway? And in the case of you think that's bad, I've been so obsessed with catastrophe for so long that there's this quality of, you know, the line comes from the story you're about to have me read from, where the narrator's mother and wife get together and they just start telling each other stories about the narrator. And at one point, the mother goes, "You think that's bad?" You know, and they just keep piling on. Here's a story of my life. Whatever I did wasn't good enough. Anything I figured out too late. And whenever I tried to help, I made things worse. That's what it's been like for me as far back as I can remember. Whenever I was about to get somewhere, something would step in and block me. Whenever I was about to finally have something, something would happen to take it away. The story of your life is that you're not to blame for anything, my mother always said when I told her that. Out of everybody on earth, you're the only one who never did anything wrong. Whatever happens, it's always somebody else's fault. It is always somebody else's fault, I told her. Poor you, she always said back, screwed by the world. Hey, Dr. Jägermeister's calling, I used to tell her. Bottoms up. And she'd just go back to whatever it was she was watching. So what's the deal with dinner, sometimes I'd say. You have a busy day? Go to Pizza Hunt, she'd tell me. Then he says a bad thing. It gets better.
Jim Shepherd, reading from his short story collection, You Think That's Bad. You're listening to excerpts from our 2013 Clarion Award-winning interviews from the Association for Women in Communications here on New Letters on the Air. Our next author, Alex George, published his fifth novel, a three-generational family epic about German immigrants in Missouri, called A Good American, in 2012, just around the time the English author became a U.S. citizen. Here's Alex George on his writing process.
I write in a terribly unprofessional way, in that I don't know what's going to happen when I start. So it's very organic, but I start with some characters and a basic idea, and I knew that I wanted these two people, both in their own way, sort of larger than life, and what would happen to them and how they would react to moving. That was one of the interesting things as an immigrant myself. One feels ambivalent about things. And what I did was to effectively sort of bifurcate myself and to split the two sentiments that I had and give one to Frederick and one to Jette to see how those played out. It occurred to me that although in some ways my journey to Missouri in 2003 couldn't have been much more different, there are certain things that are probably very similar and certain emotions that everybody feels, and whether that's the hope for a new life or fear for the unknown. And there's also this paradox, which I try and explore in the book, between wanting to fit in to your new home but not ever forgetting where it is that you came from.
What made you decide to make them German immigrants?
That was for a number of reasons. First of all, I wanted to write about Missouri because it's where I live and because I think there's something quintessentially American about the place. It is a flyover state. I don't like that term, but certainly thinking about it from an English point of view, when you think of America, you don't think of Missouri.
Right.
You might think of New York or Disney World.
Or California.
Or California.
Right.
Probably not Jefferson City. So that was the first thing. And once I'd made the decision to set it in Missouri, then having them be German was the next logical step because there are so many German immigrants here.
Right, right.
Having them arrive in the country without being able to speak a word allowed me to explore struggles with language. So that was another reason. And then the final reason was because I wanted to explore the paradoxes of World War One. From a sort of writer's point of view and looking to create tension and drama, having them be German worked as well. When America declared war in 1917, the impact on German communities was enormous. And suddenly people felt unable to speak German. There were stories that I read about somebody defending Germany in an argument in St. Louis who was taken out and lynched.
Mm-hmm.
And as if people were bending over backwards to prove who they were and who they weren't anymore. On the level of the book, Frederick, who adores his country and feels that he has a debt to America that he needs to repay, he's too old to be conscripted, but he signs up against Jette's wishes because he wants to repay that debt. And so he finds himself in the position of going back to Europe and fighting against his old countrymen, which to me was the ultimate sacrifice and also the ultimate indicator of just how far he had traveled that he was willing to do that and how much he loved his new country.
I love the synchronicity of it, that you should write this book that happens to be titled A Good American, because I know you've written four other novels while you were in England.
My first four books are very, very different books. I was published in the UK by HarperCollins at the end of the 90s and published four books in fairly quick succession.
Were they mysteries? Were they adventures?
No, they were comedies. This was back when chick lit was a huge thing, and they were trying to create a new genre, almost of lad lit type thing. And
my
toes are curling as I say that, along the lines of Nick Hornby and those sorts of people.
Okay, yeah.
Because of that, I very quickly found myself in something of a rut, and my editors would say, well, no, you need to do more of this and more of this. And that was difficult for me. And talk about honing my craft, which is a very nice way of putting it, because my first two books were awful. And if I could go out and find them all and buy them all and then put them in a big pile and light a match under them, I would do that in an instant. The third and fourth books aren't quite so bad. But, you know, I did my apprenticeship in public. And I kind of wish I hadn't. But having had that experience, when I finished my fourth book and I was out of contract, I felt that I had the freedom then to write the book that I'd actually been wanting to write for some time. So I shut the door of my cabin and started to write the book that I really wanted to write, which was a bigger, more ambitious novel. They always say, write what you know. And I think write what you know is a good theory, as long as you actually know something that's worth writing about. And then it struck me that the experience of moving my life to a new country, 4,000 miles away from my home and my family and my friends, with no expectation that I would ever return, might actually qualify as being something that was worth writing about.
Alex George on his novel, A Good American. This is New Letters on the Air, and we'll finish with another look across generations, this time with a family of poets. Puerto Rican-born Anita Velez Mitchell, her Puerto Rican daughter, Gloria Vando, and granddaughter, musician-poet Annika Paris. I spoke with Gloria and Annika when they visited the Writer's Place in Kansas City for its 20th anniversary about their book, Woven Voices, Three Generations of Puerto Rican Poets Look at Their American Lives, which inspired the musical drama Temple of the Souls.
I'm a co-composer with my writing partner, Dean Landon.
Yes.
And we actually, the libretto was written by my grandmother. It was originally in verse. It was all poetry. And it's now a musical drama because I said, we don't write opera. I love opera, but I'm a commercial writer. So a lot of actually songwriters now are writing musical theater. And so when they asked us to write the music, I said it's really going to be more of a musical drama. Leonard Bernstein, Stephen Sondheim, that kind of music was very familiar for me, but not Figaro. So we put the piece together and it ran for 3 weeks in New York off Broadway. And it was the proudest moment of my life.
And Annika's sister, my daughter, Lorca Perez, was the director and the producer. And she has a company called Multi Stages. And incidentally, she designed the cover for our book.
We love each other.
I know.
I was just going to get around to my sister, Lorca, too, who's named after Garcia Lorca.
I figured as much. But I wondered if this particular poem, Totem Taino, if this might have been the beginning of that musical. Is it, in a way?
It started with the poem.
Yes, and the poem? Yes, this is the poem.
Okay.
And oh, we have to read it.
It was inspired by the caves of Camay, which is in Puerto Rico. My mother went and she felt the presence of the Taínos.
Taíno, which I mentioned in the poem as well, are the indigenous people of Puerto Rico before Christopher Columbus came. They had the Indians in America. When Christopher Columbus came to Puerto Rico, the Taínos were the indigenous people. So I mentioned the Taínos as well.
And that's what happens in the opera too, where the you know, they committed suicide, many of them, rather than be enslaved by the Spanish, because they thought they were gods.
And she felt their presence.
She really
caves.
Felt their presence, and she sat down and wrote this.
Well, she said also that the rain that was dripping on the walls of this cave made her think of the tears of the Taínos. Uh-huh. And she felt their spirit And so she wrote, the piece is called Temple of the Souls, and it's the actual—
the musical.
The musical. And the cliff is where they would jump to their suicide to save their pride. They didn't want to be enslaved or raped, because women were raped, or murdered.
Right.
So it was a pretty violent time and a pretty sad time. And this is a love story between a Taino Indian and a conquistador's daughter. Right. So it's very much parallel to a Romeo and Juliet theme.
And West Side Story.
And West Side Story.
If we want to carry it on in the musical vein.
Yes.
Yeah. You know what we could do, which might be kind of fun? Gloria, I could have you read in Spanish, and then Annika, you could read in English, and we could go back and forth that way. Would you guys like to try that?
Why not?
Totem Taíno. El Taíno vivía en las cumbres. La paz era su nobleza.
The Taíno lived on the mountain. Peace was his noble bequest. To evade his enemy, the Caribe, he took refuge in the caves, a bow and arrow his sole defense.
When
the avaricious infidels disembark on his shore, with their smugness and swagger, their dogs and firearms ready for war, they plunder his mountains, profane his cultures, his caves, rape his women, enslave his children, steal his gold, and shatter his ark and his bow.
Muere el cacique Aguaibana, el valeroso guerrero.
Their leader, intrepid and bold, his skin tattooed in colors on his chest, a medallion of gold, and hanged from a flamboyant tree. His soul ascended to heaven, but his cry remains entombed in the heart of his hollow cave, locked in our conscience forever, where his spirit still claims us today. Sobs reverberate, thick tears drop in the cavernous womb of Mother Earth. Time has softened our pride and melted our hearts of stone. In the sweetness of our fruits, the essence of our flowers, and the beauty of our land, the Taíno soul lives on. Let us pray those evil intruders never dare return to destroy a nation and enslave a people on their own soil as they did back then. Let the oceans rage and rise. Let the lava from Borinquen flow. Let it cleanse our guilt and guide us back to the Arieto, back to the ritual chant of the Taíno.
Taíno de amor y paz, Borinquen.
Taíno of love and peace, Borinquen is your homeland. We offer you, blessed spirits, a gold mine of regret.
Te imploramos, ay bendito Dios, una mina de perdón.
We implore you, ay bendito Dios,
perdón, perdón, perdón.
Forgive us, forgive us, forgive us.
Totem Taíno by Anita Velez Mitchell, read by her daughter Gloria Vando and granddaughter Annika Paris from their book Woven Voices, the 2013 second place winner of the International Latino Book Award. We're hearing music from their poem-inspired musical drama, Temple of the Souls, that won 4 OLA awards from the Hispanic Organization of Latin Actors. All of today's featured author interviews were part of the entry that won New Letters on the Air, the 2013 Clarion Award for Best Radio Interview Show. You can still hear the individual shows on our website, newletters.org, but hurry, things are changing fast. We're still trying to keep New Letters on the air and in your podcast lineup. To find out how to help, email radio@newletters.org or follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Today's show was originally produced with Stephanie Hughes, Annie Walsh, and Jamie Walsh. I'm Angela Elam for New Letters on the Air.